Yeah, I think Hans has really hit the nail on the head too, because he talks about how can we be essentially a catalyst for some change here. And just a couple of things by way of background. I'm not going to go through the detailed slides, but it's interesting because some of the messages we've received probably conflict a little bit with the messages you've received, and we'll try and see if I can reconcile those as well. But essentially, we're worried about disclosure as well. We haven't been doing nothing. We've been watching with interest the number of studies that people have put together, the work and the reports of ICAS and Zika. So it's the Scottish and New Zealand Institutes, the UK bodies have put together a couple of reports, one more generally about disclosure frameworks as well as cutting the clutter. The work of EFRAG, working with the UK and the French Standards Centre and others, there is lots of work going on. ESMA, the IAASB, a wide range of bodies. And so we've been keeping an eye on this, and now we think the time is basically for us to act as well. I'm also conscious, and I want to outline a couple of things here that we're thinking of doing. You advised us about a year ago that there's no such thing as a quick win, so I'm going to suggest three or four things that we could do quickly that might be good winnings. So that's the challenge for us. So just by way of background, the other thing too is that keep in mind the conceptual framework's very important, because we are going to have some disclosure principles in there, and that's going to generally shape, I think, some principles about aggregation, about when adding things to the notes or explanatory notes, financial statements is appropriate. In other words, when is it appropriate to supplement the main financial statements? So some of the very core principles will be in there. But if we wait for that to finish, that's, even though we're going really fast on it, that's, you know, 2015. By the time we know setting standards, it would be another 3 or 4 years potentially before we can make some changes to things like IS1 and IS7, which are our basic financial statement requirements, without even thinking about what we might do to more generally sweep through and have a look at disclosure requirements across the full suite of standards. So we think we should do some things now to try and generate some change. So here's the background. This was more of a providing you an overview about why we're asking this. Essentially, we've got a session today which takes us up to lunch, and that we've been reviewing what's been going on. We held a disclosure forum. I want to describe what we did in the forum, what we heard, and probably more importantly is the last bit of this, is what steps we might take next. I do want to emphasise up front, our board hasn't had a look at these steps yet, so these are ideas that have been developing within the staff and others that we'll take to the board, so I don't want to be presumptive at all that the board will actually do any of these. So, by way of background, going into this, our agenda consultation told us quite clearly that there is an issue with disclosure. They thought we should develop a disclosure framework to try and reduce the burden on preparers and increase help informativeness to investors. And so we decided that, given that it was part of our framework, but that's going to take time, we should also put together a disclosure forum or discussion forum and bring parties together and try to see if there's something we can do in the more immediate term. So we're looking at ways that we can change behaviour to see whether we as the standard setters can do some things that will actually trigger or be a catalyst for those behavioural changes, and what other projects you might be able to do that anticipate what's happening with the framework. And just to jump ahead, for example, we could actually do some work on materiality, on knowing that we're going to end up still having materiality mentioned in the framework, but we're not going to have lots of application guidance. That's actually a standards level project. So actually doing some exploratory work and starting to put things together now could actually be very helpful. So let me give you an idea of what we did. Just ahead of this disclosure or discussion forum on 28th of January, we put together a survey and had it online, and we got 225 responses. And the nice thing is we actually got 45 from users, which is a pretty good hit rate for us. So about 50% were preparers, 30% were people like the regulators and auditors and so on. Given that it was over the Christmas period, we a really good hit rate. We're actually doing a follow-up aimed at mid-caps, because the mid-caps have come to us and said, well, there's a disproportionate burden on us. We've made it quite clear that we don't have an appetite to create a differential disclosure framework for them, but we are interested in seeing where they believe that the biggest burden actually sits. So we're doing that at the end of March. We should have those results. but 225 is not bad. Now, we got similar messages to EFRAG in that there were two issues here. One was, and I almost summarised this in relation to two of the documents that were put together. One is about clutter, and that's the left-hand side, poor communication. Most of the users tended to believe that was a lack of connectivity or communication within the document. They couldn't see what was going on. They couldn't see the connections between things. On the preparer side, it's more like, and by the way, that clutter is the work that the UK ASB did. On the right-hand side, disclosure overlay is consistent with the excess baggage documentation that was put together by the Scottish and New Zealand institutes. Preparers see this as being, there's just too much to put in there. So they see this as disclosure overload. So I don't know if that helps reconcile the thinking or the analysis you got back at EFRAG, because it seemed that the different parties had different views on this. You know, preparers are kind of looking at this and saying, we've just got a huge list of things we have to comply with, great big list of compliance requirements. It just feels like overload to us. And if I can relate back to when we did a review of IFRS 7, somebody said to us in a session, by the time I'd complied with the standard, I was so tired to think about meeting the disclosure objective, I just couldn't do it. So that's kind of the thinking there. So with that in mind, we put a discussion forum together on the 28th of January. It was very well attended. We had 120 external attendees, plus 40 people. We webcast this so that we actually had people from all around the world. 40 of them stayed on the full morning and then 25 in the afternoon, which is not bad given we have people from Hong Kong, Australia, and the US, as well as across Europe. We also had really good attendance from our board and staff. Essentially, the way we ran it, for those who weren't there, is we started off, Ian introduced it and setting out our objectives for the day. We then had two guest speakers. We had Paul Lee and Russell Pico. So we deliberately set it up, essentially somebody speaking on behalf of the consumers or the users' information, and Russell speaking on behalf of preparers, and talking about their expectations and the problems and challenges they have in either putting together financial reports or reading them. We also had presentations from EFRAG and ICAS and ESMA and the IAASB on the work that they've been doing, because we wanted to acknowledge the good work that's been feeding into this process. After that, we got the other, what I call the actors in this process, or the other members of the financial reporting supply chain. So starting from the preparers and going to the users, in the middle we have the standard setters, the auditors and the regulators. I kind of think of them as intermediaries sometimes, in that they're helping shape the data, but they're not actually doing the preparation or the reading. Regulators certainly do some consumption as well, but these are mainly intermediaries. And then we had an open panel discussion, and I think that's the thing that's most interesting. What we heard is that there is no clear agreement on what the disclosure problem is, and I think that's consistent with EFRAG's feedback and ours. Some see this as being clutter and some see it as being overload. People have different perspectives on this. But what seemed to be quite clear in this is that investors, preparers really want to tell a story. They want to explain what their business has done, how they performed, and investors want to hear that story. And even though the standard setters, the ISB, as auditors, is providing credibility, and the same with regulators, all provide credibility to that process. One of the unfortunate downsides is it is often perceived that by giving credibility, it moves a little bit away from communication and becomes more of a compliance process. You know, we did have anecdotal things. That one of my favourite stories is an auditor who told us that we have a checklist on... I think it's IFRS requirements, and a checklist on this and a checklist on that, and we have a checklist of checklists to make sure that we haven't missed any checklists. And we had somebody else told us that they can tell, for example, who the major auditor is on a business company, because they'll look at the way they've expressed their accounting policies, and they'll be word for word with the model financial statements that firm's prepared. So there are these little anecdotes that we hear. And so the standard setters, auditors and regulators all bring credibility to the process, but the risk is that in exercising that, we switch over a little bit onto more of a compliance focus. Materiality, it came up over and over again. And it's, I think everybody, we keep on quoting, I've forgotten the paragraph number now, is it paragraph 23 or something, or of IS1, where it says you don't have to disclose something if it's not material. It doesn't matter how many times you say that, there are two issues that often come up. One is it's actually difficult to apply in practice, or I should say three issues. One, it's difficult to apply in practice, okay, they're just not quite sure. And secondly, even if we do have a consistent way of applying it, unfortunately, it means that the preparer, the onus sits on them to usually to prove to the auditor or the regulator that it's not material. And again, we have lots of anecdotes of people coming to us, and I had people talking to me yesterday about that, about the amount of documentation that they've got to produce to persuade their auditor that it's not material. Okay, so there's that aspect. So, and the third one is actually a very simple one, is that people aren't quite sure when we say that something is material and you have to comply, doesn't mean that if you've got a material number in your balance sheet for pensions that you must disclose everything about pensions and the pension standard, or does that immaterial thing still apply to materiality standard? In other words, do I ask that question, is it material or not, up front, or do I ask it later? It's a very simple question, but people are worried about that. We had several suggestions. One is about us providing more application guidance, and I think that's one thing we'll talk about in a minute, whether we provide more application guidance, whether we think about taking away that presumption, in other words, the standard setter now and again, saying, look, let's presume it's not material unless the following factors are present, for example, so you switch that around. And the third is that it was some people suggested it might be very helpful if we actually link our discussions on disclosure specifically back to the objective. And by doing that, it's a very specific focus and it might be easy to apply materiality. So there were some suggestions there. Also came down, better linkages required, and that's linked between the policies, risks, related financial information. And I'm going to give a little bit of feedback too, which I think contradicts some of the messages that I heard about the order matters, in that we heard quite clearly the order of the financial reports does matter. We want to see the most important bits first, which is not the same as seeing a standardised format. So we've got to work our way through that. So, form matters, the order matters in terms of importance. That was stated to us, and they said we got some feedback, and I'll mention the specifics of what we could do about it. They said that the standards actually constrain them. Okay, I was surprised when I heard that until I reread IS1 again. I should read it more often, but I'll tell you about some of the constraints we have in IS1 in a minute. Again, technology came up, and they said could help. But I think most of the feedback was two things. It moves us away from that communication to compliance again, and we're not there yet. Okay. And in other cases, people continually say, well, maybe we should put accounting policies onto websites. Well, you can't do that in some jurisdictions. So while there are some good ideas, there are some barriers to actually getting there. A couple of people mentioned integrated reporting and country-by-country reporting came up as well, but I just wanted to acknowledge that we are listening, and mid-caps as well was another issue. So despite all of this, the way I read the day is that there's some really good ideas, but there are still some legal institutional barriers in there, and there are some barriers that are created by the standard setter, which I'll talk about in a minute. It became very clear to us that preparers said the line of least resistance is to simply disclose, partly because if you fail to disclose something, then you'll often be asked to explain and justify why. You may as well just do it. And the other thing, too, is a very important point, is the cost of failure is very, very high. So if you decide to take the high ground and cut out what you think is irrelevant disclosures, and then subsequently were shown that information might have been helpful, there's a very big price to pay, both in terms of regulation and reputation. So preparers were very cautious about that. In other words, the incentives aren't right. So there were some very powerful messages in there. But we didn't want this to be a talk fest. We wanted to get something substantial out of this. And so what we plan to do is a feedback statement. We're looking towards the end of March for this. It will actually summarise the whole of the Scotia thing, because we're hoping that we can actually use this as a document that we can go and go to other jurisdictions associated with conferences, etc. It will publish the survey results, and so on, and then outline, and this is the bit that we haven't discussed with the board yet, the next steps. Now I'll slow down a bit and go through a couple of things I want to describe. We are considering whether to suggest and recommend to the board that we make some amendments to IS1. Now, these would be one of the main purposes of this. They are substantive in many respects, but it's also a catalyst. We think the message we got loud and clear was that in order to help stimulate some behavioural changes, because it does require behavioural change, making some small changes to the way we express IS1 might actually be helpful in that process. Now, in materiality, there are at least two areas in there. It's been suggested to us that we don't change the words about saying, you know, you don't have to disclose information if it's not material. But at the moment, it's a lonely little sentence, and it doesn't explain why we actually have that sentence in the first place. In IFRS 12, one of our newer standards, we actually have a paragraph that explains that, on the one hand, if we don't have a disclosure requirement in there, but there's something that an investor ought to know that helps meet the objective, then you're not limited to just those disclosure requirements. You put that extra information in. On the other hand, it says that you can actually obfuscate or hide information by simply mechanically disclosing things that aren't material. In other words, it explains the context. We don't explain why it is that we have the sentence in IS1 that says don't disclose things if they're not material. So one possibility is to actually expand that section and explain why it's important that you don't disclose immaterial information and, in essence, end up making the financial statements more difficult to read. That will draw people's attention to that and reinvigorate, we think, the focus on that paragraph. We also have to, we think it may be worthwhile addressing the issue of, as I say, if you've got a material item in your balance sheet, it doesn't force you to disclose everything in a standard and emphasise that materiality applies at the standards level as well as at that very general level. Now, Filippo mentioned the order of presentation. IS1 at the moment says that you have to present your financial statements in a structured manner. They should be in a systematically presented. And then it goes on to say the normal order of presentation shall be, or is, the accounting policies, followed by notes. You've got the financial statements, then accounting policies, and then the notes normally presented in the same order as the items in the balance sheet. In other words, if that's probably liquidity order, for example, or the same order as financial statements. So it almost structures you to follow the structure of the income statement and balance sheet, even if that's not the most important. Similarly, we're given examples, and two I'll use are ITV and the Man Group, where people actually applauded what they had done by presenting the accounting policy and some financial information together in context. Well, that's not what IS1 says. Well, the normal order is accounting policies and then the notes and so on. So one of the questions is whether we try and break that by giving more flexibility, just by removing some of those barriers. We talk about how important significant accounting policies are, and yet we have a paragraph in IS1 that says that you should disclose significant policies. But by the way, if you pay tax, we expect to see a tax note. And then it has another sentence that says, just because the items aren't material doesn't mean the policy's not. And if anybody reading that in plain English, it looks as if you have to disclose an accounting policy for everything, no matter how significant. So we should challenge that. We then, some of the minimum disclosure requirements, and I'll come back to XBRL actually, you know, we do very simple things like, say, you must disclose trade and other payables. And then people tell us, I can't put trade payables on the balance sheet and then other payables because it says I have to put trade and other payables. Surely I can separate the two. It's the same with goodwill and other intangible assets and so on. So there may be some areas where, in fact, we're too restrictive, we don't explain that a little bit of flexibility actually may improve communication. Yeah, we have an item on the balance that says you must disclose trade and other payables. Okay, so some people have got a big trade payable number and then they've got some other payables in there, and they actually believe that they have to put on the balance sheet trade and other payables as one number and then in the notes separate them out. You actually can't do it on the face. That's not what my reading of the standard is, but it's seen by many as a constraint. Then there's a risky one. The investors might like this. The investors have been telling us for a long time now that they want to see a reconciliation of net debt. And if we're going to provide a little bit more flexibility, perhaps we should use this as an opportunity to ask whether that would be an appropriate addition. I'm always nervous about adding something. Any project to simplify disclosures when you just simply add is not a good thing. But this might be a chance to ask that question as well. I'll skip through the next bit so we can open up for discussion, but materiality. Our initial discussions are, I think we have about three paragraphs on materiality in the framework. We probably think that's about enough. We don't need to have a huge amount of detail. That's a standards level issue. And if we are going to pretty much preserve the materiality discussions we have in the framework, then we can anticipate that and we actually should start to discuss some application of materiality. Get the discussion going. We should take a lead on it. The work that ESMA did highlighted and the feedback they got is that it's up to standards setters should take the lead on that. So that's what we think we should do. And work with the International, the Auditing Standards Board and with ESMA and other regulators, IOSCO, to understand better what sort of application guidance would be appropriate for materiality. Well, the idea is generally, and whether that we actually have some materiality specific guidance, believe it or not, related party disclosures. We're quite clear in that, saying that the special nature of that relationship really makes that material for not just for numerical reasons, but because of the nature of that relationship. So we should see whether or not we need to provide any specific materiality guidance in a particular standard, or whether providing more general guidance about how to assess materiality would be more helpful. Well, we could put that, that's one of the next issues, is IS1. I think it's that. IS1 and IS7, which are really our two, they shape the whole financial statements. That's an area where we actually have the paragraph now that says you don't have to disclose something that's not material. That's where you could think about adding some application guidance or developing some education material that's a little bit more flexible about how we work with materiality. So, as well as those quite specific things within IS1, the IS1 would be a short-term thing. Okay, that's something we would consider, we'd have a look at this year, because those are, we think, relatively simple, relatively clean proposals that might provide the catalyst today. I think looking at disclosure requirements more generally, and they are, in essence, rekindling our financial statement presentation project and re-looking at IS1 and IS7, and then looking at disclosure requirements more generally. You know, some people think that we should go and gather up all the disclosure sections of every standard and put them into one place. You know, I personally don't, because I think that disclosures, there's a trade-off sometimes between recognition principles, and you have to understand why you've got that disclosure requirement. But those are the debates we need to have. That general review of disclosure, I think because it's a standards level project, we can actually start to do the groundwork for that, so that as soon as we finish the framework, we're ready to go. We shouldn't wait until the framework's completed. We should start to gather information. And then we've got some additional consultation. Use this to get wider views and to get people, use this as a catalyst for change. This is many discussion forums. We are talking to the mid-caps. Again, this is not to create a differential reporting framework, but one of the points they make is they feel as if it's a disproportionate burden. If you can actually reduce the disclosure burden for everybody, they'll feel a lot better than some of the the big companies will, because they say, you know, we've only got one person doing disclosure. These companies have got 10 people. We haven't got the resources. You help everybody, you'll help us actually more than most. So we're doing some additional work with them. And then it's important that we if we do work on materiality and other things, that we get the regulators and the auditors involved as well. But I think we want to take a lead on this and as quickly as we can. That's probably a good point to get reactions or general discussion.
Well, me, you've covered a lot of territory. Reactions. Shazan.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a quick question. In some jurisdictions, disclosure requirements are set by securities regulators rather than by standard setters. Therefore, coordination with an endorsement from regulatory bodies are very important. And my question is that after we finish the disclosure requirement, do we need to get formal endorsement from securities or regulatory agencies such as IOSCO? And how, if we need to get endorsement, what are we going to do? How we can get the endorsement?
Just brief response. What we're talking about is disclosure requirements that fit within IFRSs. So within a given jurisdiction, you'd simply follow the normal endorsement processes you do for IFRSs. So these are not supplementary ones. We're aware in some jurisdictions that they have additional disclosure requirements. In fact, some of the burdens perceived to be because of that, those additional requirements. And I know the FASB has been doing some work to try and reduce the overlap between MD&A and financial reporting. But these, we're just looking at changes to IFRSs.
John.
I mean, I think that ultimately we have to acknowledge the only way to reconcile the preparer concerns with the investor concerns is to focus on the communication side. And I do think that if you have some sort of general principle around the need to put disclosures into the context of the business model, then a preparer actually, that helps to focus the preparer on making on how to make a decision as to whether something's material or not. Because if you can't actually articulate why that particular disclosure is relevant to the business model, it's almost certainly immaterial. And that may be the way to explore going forward. I think the knock-on effect of that is you have to accept that there may be more, in some areas we may need more disclosure in order to get rid of less in some other areas. And this isn't an exercise of taking a red pen. This is a significant restructuring area.
Vincent.
Thanks. I just have two questions. I think Filippo, in his presentation, did talk about the different feedback that was gotten from the U.S. as well as from the EFRAG responses with regards to the forward-looking information versus the past-oriented information. I was just wondering, to what extent did this forum also touch on this issue, and what was the feedback you got? And if you could also give some indication of this, you may have touched on this, but if you could just reaffirm the specific steps you take in that regard, the forward-looking information. And then the other question I had was that the response rate from users seemed pretty low. I know it's better than usual. You are 20%, as you've mentioned. But I was a bit surprised that in that regard, users are not a target for additional outreach, given the low response rate. So do you have a plan to reach out to users also on this issue? Because you've commendably, in your coverage of the IS1, you've talked about a specific item which users have been calling for, the net debt reconciliation. But could there be more items that other users may need to be addressed that you may not necessarily have touched on?
Just on the two items, the forward-looking, we didn't really discuss that in a lot of detail. Even though it's a relevant part of the discussion, our focus is mainly on saying, well, what problems can we address within the context of our current financial reporting? I think the idea of more forward-looking information and how management commentary relates to that, it's outside the scope of this little part of the project. We want to try and improve the financial reports today if we can. The second thing in terms of you might think it's a low response rate. That's stunning for standard setters to get 45 people to reply from users. It's still not good enough because we can do more. I just want to assure you that that Hilary Eastman did some additional outreach as well, and it's on the CMAC, which is our user forum, essentially, next Thursday. So we continue to talk to that. I think it's on the CRUF agenda, that's this Corporate Reporting User Forum, later this week. So we're going out to user groups and getting as much feedback as we can.
Mark.
Yeah, perhaps it is actually related to what Alan just said, but I think that the you talked about the linkage and the communication part, and I think in what you sum up as next steps, and many of them I think make a lot of sense. I was missing a bit the linkage point, Alan, but you're saying management commentary is not part of this, but I think you probably need to revisit that, and you need to bring it into the picture. If you really want to look at, for example, placement criteria, if you're going to take certain disclosures out of the, and say, well, for example, risk disclosures need to be rationalized, you also need to take into account what goes into the management commentary. I think the two are linked, and somehow you need to reflect that in the project plan, would be my recommendation.
Ron?
Thank you, Paul. Just a couple of remarks. One, we are very supportive of all the action to increase and improve disclosures. Second, we'd like to echo the point on from Vincent, is that we really think that users and investors should be further looked at and taken into further consideration, and even if 20% could appear as a success, I think it's still very low, and I think we're sharing the same concern regarding the IFRAG study. And third, you've mentioned our work on materiality, and thanks for that, and also thanks for putting that on the list of items to be tackled, and just express our very strong support to further assist you in that if it's possible.
Rudolph.
Yeah, just an observation from a preparer's perspective. When I think of the questions that come in from users, they're typically very current topical type of matters and industry specific, and I'm just wondering, you know, maybe whether a industry specific view might be useful with respect to the, or emphasizing industry specific matters more might be useful with respect to the disclosure network framework.
Priority to those who had not spoken before or not as much as some of the rest of us, but I think now maybe I'll just carry up the line. Andrew.
Thank you. I would perhaps be reasonably ambitious in this because I do believe that it is possible to make some changes to IS1 in the short term, which would bring quite constructive and sensible improvement. I also think that there is a longer-term project to look at disclosures in more detail, so the focus is on what could be done practically in the short term. I think this is quite important for the board because it gives the board an opportunity to demonstrate that it's really listening to concerns and is doing something to help. I very much endorse action for that. And also something to break the circle of the preparers, the auditors, and the regulators all looking over each other's shoulders, wondering whether everything happens to have been included or not. It would be very helpful. Being ambitious, I would suggest that something appropriately flagged could probably be in place and effective for December 2013 year ends. That sounds pretty short term. It is. But the board has done things very quickly before.
I see you've lost your sense of humor.
Oh, I'm particularly enthusiastic about this. On materiality, I would agree with Alan's comments. I think that there could be changes made to IS1 to clarify how materiality should be applied. The current guidance in IS1 and materiality is very old. It dates from when IS1 came in almost, which itself is a very old standard, which was well before we had the very large number of disclosure requirements in IFRS. and I think it would be helpful to do something to catch up with that and also break some of the misconceptions that people have. So that, for example, if a standard has, here's a principle and a list of information to disclose to meet it, that doesn't mean everything's mandatory. And there are examples around of where clearly immaterial information is simply being disclosed. So I think that would be very helpful. It would be useful to have some examples. That could be included in, perhaps as an appendix to IS1, and a good basis for conclusions to demonstrate why the board is doing it. Because all of this is needed to generate behavioural change. It's a stimulation of behavioural change, and it needs to be something quite pushy to make it happen. On the question of positioning, I think that it would be quite helpful in financial statements for there to be some mechanism to get the important information at the start of the notes. And I would link that, as I think someone's already said, to the business model itself. Something which you almost have something that says, here's what this business does to generate profits and cash flows, here are the key risks, and here are the key notes and other disclosures that relate to that. Tell the story. If people can be encouraged to do that in their financial statements, I believe that would bring great improvement, and it could be done very quickly indeed. I wouldn't, at this stage, change any requirements in any standard other than IAS 1. I don't think that's necessary. As has been said by many before, as soon as you threaten to take away a disclosure in a standard, someone will say, I need it. I think it would be a fruitless route to go. Change IAS 1 to get focus on the right things would be the way that I would go, and also flag that there will be a longer-term project to look at it more in the context of the overall future of financial reporting. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. There are a number of cards up. This is a hugely important topic. I don't want you to feel under pressure to not to make your useful comments. We have the time. My suggestion is let's break for lunch. See if we can have 45 minutes. If we could aim to be back at 1 o'clock, we'll continue the discussion, give everyone an opportunity to express your views, and for Alan to reflect. And we'll still finish, I think, certainly not later than the scheduled time, and more likely a bit early. Fair enough?
Yep.
So let's aim to be back at 1 p.m., please. Well, let's spend a few more minutes getting reactions to Alan's presentation on what can be done both short-term and longer-term relative to disclosure. I think we are working our way up this side. So, Anne, if you would.
I'll go very quickly. You've got your time constraint. From the investor perspective, knowing and the ICGN, we discussed the issues about disclosure. We would recommend very much that there be the short-term, longer-term picture, that you do have some issues you could solve in IAS1, then let's get on to them and get them done, because the conceptual framework's going to be a little bit longer in gestation. For us, when you're looking at disclosure generally, and trying to solve the clutter problem, we would not recommend that you be moving anything out of financial statements that has that is important to investors, because that's audited, the other material is not necessarily so. So we want to be very clear about what might or might not be moved if you're trying to solve clutter issues. The other areas that we agree with you that need... I think, personally, it needs guidance rather than expansion in IAS1. But the issues are what broader. Yes, there's materiality and the application of materiality, absolutely critical. But I would suggest, from an investor perspective, we are looking at a lot more in terms of how estimates, judgments are arrived at, the basis of those estimates and judgments. Also, particularly, the basis of going concern. Other than that, I'll leave the rest because of the time constraint, but that's what we would like focused on.
Panagiotis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very briefly, to support the initiatives. Also, on our part, to highlight that the the current financial crisis has shown that there is an issue of lack of appropriate information, let's say. And also we have seen reporting, financial reporting information that has been either inadequate or misleading, or, and has led to, of course, the well-known issue of lack of trust also among financial institutions. So we strongly welcome the initiatives, and we think that the work could contribute to harmonizing the financial statement presentation of similar transactions. That will be a very important contribution. Thank you.
Christoph.
Very briefly about the application guidance for materiality. It's a number of years ago that the SEC issued CEPS 99, which one may consider application guidance for materiality. It may help to look into that, whether that had actually made things better or worse. So before starting an own project on application guidance for materiality. The second one is on accounting policy disclosures. I think that could be reduced significantly if people were told that they shouldn't simply copy everything from the standards, but focus on things that are not taken straight from the standard. So that you do impairment testing on goodwill is something that the standard tells you, why do you need to say it in the financial statements yet again? So I think that could make people focus with regard to the accounting policies on the things where it's really there's choice and judgment rather than repeating stuff.
Charles.
Thank you, Paul. As someone who's had their foot in the user camp for more than 40 years and the preparer camp for the last 15 years, I see both sides of the clutter and the compliance tension and frustration. And there's no doubt that communication should be the goal, and that requires a behavioural change. And whilst I absolutely applaud what the board is doing, and I think there are a number of improvements that can be made, and I think a number of them do relate to IAS 1, I think a lot of the benefit of enhanced communication probably could be incorporated into an improved MD&A section. But ultimately, for behavioural change to really take place, and I'm going to offend a number of people in this room, it's going to require a massive mindset change by regulators. Because having observed cycles for more than 40 years, we repeat the same mistake at the end of every cycle. We always look for more regulation, more information, more disclosure, more this, more that, after every cycle, and we now end up with documents that are designed to enable users to make investment decisions that, quite frankly, they either do not read, because who's going to read a 300-page prospectus, or they are so opaque and difficult to identify because they are written with one purpose, not to inform the investor, but to protect the people who are producing the document, and therefore there's a compliance focus purely and simply. As much as I think these improvements will produce some benefits, they will be at the margin in terms of changing behaviour unless we can change the mindset of regulators and have them focus on the communication aspect in terms of the utility of what is being produced rather than what has to go into the document to comply.
Thanks, Charles. Rioso.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have one comment and one question. Comment. I support the comment of Vincent saying the question how much emphasis we put on past performance and how much emphasis we put on future cash flow is an important one, and I agree with him. The question might be fitted to this council as well, because it's not just a technical question, but it's a strategic question affecting both conceptual framework and the disclosure framework, and maybe fitted to this group of diversity covering preparers and investors. My question is related to the comment EFRAG got to their discussion paper. That comment is about the disclosure requirements being developed on an ad hoc basis, and it has resulted in a relatively extensive requirement. And I think it is an important point, and I would like to hear the IFAS ISB possible next steps include steps addressing that aspect, or and if so, which part of the next step would be addressing the question? Thank you.
Thank you. Patrick.
Thank you. I would like to react on the role of regulators. I was a participant to the Disclosures Forum, and there was a very interesting presentation made by Russell Pico from HSBC, which showed very clearly that the increase of volume is not only related to the volume of the financial statements, but also on the volume of other types of information that are provided in the financial report. For instance, the volume of MD&A. So I understand part of the comments made about the role of regulators. Something was said during this forum, which was that preparers and auditors don't like receiving questions from regulators, and therefore they have, for some of them at least, a compliance approach in order to avoid questions. And I totally agree with the fact that we have to change the mindset. Because as regulators, we are in agreement with the fact that compliance is not an objective per se. We need to get relevant information, information about the most significant, the most important parts of the financial statements that are presented. And therefore, I do agree with the initiative that is taken by the IISB on this matter. And maybe as regulators, we could make a proposal in order to change the mindset, which is to joint our efforts in that project.
Begona?
Thank you. Yes, a minor question. Well, I wonder if we are talking about disclosure in general, including we are trying to expand the financial statements to the management report, or we are focused only in the notes to the accounts and then in IS1. So this is just to clarify that.
Zenga.
Thank you. My comment is that this whole initiative, I think, is very timely. There are quite a lot of initiatives underway. For example, you have the integrated reporting, and we just signed this MOU, the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force report. And it's really begging to the whole issue of everyone, I think, which we recognize, you know, trying to get more relevant information from the reports. I think there needs to be some amount of coordination between the various initiatives. So it's helpful to see the MOU. And then, you know, with respect to the standards themselves, you know, we really want to make sure that we don't fall into a trap of becoming very prescriptive. It really needs to be heavily principles-based and trying to convey a story about you know, what is the business model, and see, well, what is appropriate for the financial statements, what is appropriate for the MD&A. For example, in the enhanced disclosure, probably a lot of the information there may be more relevant for the MD&A, but in some instances there may be information that we can actually include already in the financial statements, which are already part of the requirements, but because of the way in which, you know, as each new standard comes on, it's really a matter of adding, just adding, as opposed to looking at everything holistically. Maybe we have an opportunity to try to collaborate and see, well, where is it best suited to have the information to tell the appropriate story.
And apologies, Karen, I skipped over you. So.
That's all right, I figured it was intentional. this issue of disclosure overload is a big one in Canada right now, I think because of the recent changeover, and I hear just a ton of chatter about how everybody's notes are 30% longer than they were under Canadian GAAP. I think, Ellen, you've got the causes from the survey and the forum. My personal view would be that the root cause is it happens because the checklist is applied and then no one goes back and applies a materiality filter. So I think any guidance you can provide on how to apply materiality would be really, really helpful, and it would assist the prepare community in making those arguments that they then need to make with their auditors and regulators. I also think you talked briefly your notion about when to make the materiality decision, and that's really intriguing because I think we only make that decision once, and if there's an opportunity to make it twice, I think that would also assist in reducing disclosures. And the last comment I would make is just a caution about providing examples, or at least detailed examples, because they tend to then just become part of the checklist.
Well, there's been quite a range of comments made. Alan, I don't think it would be fair to you to try to respond to even most of them, but do you want to make a few observations in light of what's been said?
Only a couple just to sum up, if I may, because in fact, I think received a lot of feedback as opposed to specific questions, but a couple did come up in here, and that is, Begona, you just asked in relation to presentation versus footnotes and so on. This is about financial statements, primarily for us, the financial statements, so the primary, balance sheet, income statement, etc., and the accompanying notes. That's the main focus of this. That doesn't mean that, and that's for the short-term initiative in particular. The bigger project conceptual framework will look after the relationship between management commentary and the rest of those components. And that gets back to the forward-looking as well as the hindsight and things like that. So we're trying to do this in two phases, in that the risk is if we bite off more than we should and try to do too much, we'll end up not getting anything in place. So we're trying to get as many short-term initiatives that are really helpful, provide a catalyst for change, without people turning around saying, well, no, you shouldn't do that. Wait until you finish the framework, and that, which is the type of reaction you'll get if we go too far. So I hope that addresses also Riozo's question about forward-looking as well. I just want to mention one other thing that we do badly sometimes, that we're hopefully about to correct, and that's some of our drafting. You know, we outline a nice, clear objective, and then we say, in meeting this an objective, an entity shall, and then we list 15 items you have to disclose. Well, they're all subject to materiality, but we've started to think about whether, particularly with our exposure drafts, we should change the wording to say, in meeting this objective, the type of information that is likely to be helpful to investors or users of financial statements is, and then identify those particular items. And then it's not, the onus has shifted a little bit from being a list of mandatory disclosures and trying to think about materiality to giving people the pieces to paint the picture to tell their story. Now, we know some auditors have expressed to us some concerns about that because it could be difficult to audit, which is why we're looking at doing it for exposure drafts initially. But that's another simple little thing that we can do to implement a change and make it clear that we're actually doing that.
Thank you, Alan. I think to sum up, and reflecting back to last year when we spent a fair chunk of time discussing various initiatives that were underway, dealing with the question of disclosure, whether it's too much, too little, or just bad communication. One piece of advice we gave you was don't try to do it alone. It's much more than just a standard setting problem. So reach out to all the interested players. You did that, did it very quickly. I think that's what the primary purpose of the disclosure forum you held was, I don't say that that's the end of that approach, but at least it's engaged people. My recollection is at the time we were concerned that there were several initiatives underway that seemed to be treading the same ground and bringing them together. And I think from what we heard from EFREG earlier today and what you've said, Alan, that feedback that we understand FASB have received, that perhaps these initiatives are starting to converge and can reinforce one another. I think another advice we gave was beware of quick fixes. I think we might even have gone so far as to say there are no quick fixes. I think based on what we've heard today, I would retreat from that somewhat. My sense is that, first of all, overwhelming support for what you're doing. I heard no one disagreeing with the worth and the importance of the project. I sense strong support for a two-prong approach, and this is where I think I might eat my words in terms of no quick fixes, support for a quick fix, I think you're suggesting primarily in the context of IAS1 and elaboration on materiality, but not to the exclusion of a longer-term, more holistic approach. And I think a number of observations here are very useful in that broader picture. And I think I would stand by our earlier assessment that that broader initiative is not a quick or simple fix. And that behavior is a big part of the solution, and as is effective communication. So those are sort of the main messages I sense coming from this, but that the council, I think, is unanimous in supporting the direction in which you're moving. Anyone dissent from that view?
Vincent has his card
up. Pardon me?
Vincent.
Sorry, Vincent, are you dissenting? Or I really don't think we have much opportunity for, if you want to make a brief comment, but otherwise I'm going to close the discussion at this time.
It's just a quick question. Whether this is going to be addressed in the conceptual framework, because there's reference being made to the business model within disclosures, and it's also cropped up in a recognition and measurement context. So could you just clarify whether you're going to provide a definition for that business model?
Well, that prejudges what we're going to have in the conceptual framework, but I can assure you that disclosure principles are being discussed as part of the framework, and whether or not that relates to some other objective, we'll consider it part of the framework, but disclosure is certainly in there. We don't know yet. Business model has come up in part of our discussion about measurement and about presentation, and that's where we'll actually start to discuss that. And obviously disclosure then supplements though that primary purpose potentially. But the board hasn't reached any decisions about the business model or a definition or whether it is indeed the driver of things like measurement.
I guess, sorry, if I may just follow on. I guess the comment from my perspective, Alan, is, you know, we've talked about disclosure, making it meaningful to your business, and I know one or two people have mentioned disclosure in the context of business models. I think one of the big challenges, we all face, is actually trying to explain our story and put disclosures around our story based on the way that we manage our business. But obviously we have an accounting framework, as we know, which doesn't necessarily or doesn't always capture the way that people manage their business. So I think there's that tension. That, for me, is the overlap into the disclosure question more than anything else.
It's noted, and it's understood by the board and by the staff on the project team. So I think it's certainly under control. So I can assure you that anyway. It will come up in the discussion paper.
All right. Well, thank you, Alan. Keen interest, and I'm sure that this will be back to us, hopefully in the not-too-distant future, both on the short-term and the longer-term initiatives. All right, are we ready now to turn to financial instruments?